Good afternoon.
Do you want to gavel in?
You want to go?
Sure. Welcome to the joint informational hearing. I'll open up for the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee.
And I'll call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. And we will also open an informational meeting. Glad my co-chair is here.
And just for the record, we're opening up an informational meeting on Oregon's low-carbon fuel standard. You recall that we worked on this last session, for those of you who were around last session, and we had asked to have an update on how that work was doing from the Department of Environmental Quality. And since the House and the House co-chair and the Senate chair worked on this together, we'd asked if we could hold a joint informational meeting, and we were given permission to do that, so I was pleased that we were invited over here. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair Gilliam.
Happy to have you.
So with that, do we want to have any overview from Beth history or just invite up the department?
Bring him up.
Okay. So we have DEQ, Dick Peterson, the director, Andy Ginsberg, and we also have Michael Lawrence, is that correct? Okay. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you.
Chair, co-chairs, members of the committees, for the record, my name is Dick Peterson, Director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. With me today is Andy Ginsberg, Administrator of our AIR program, and also Michael Lawrence with the firm of Jack Fawcett and Associates. So as Madam Chair indicated, we're here to report on our work on proposed low-carbon fuel standard. Just a way of background, the 2009 legislature directed us, DEQ, to undertake a look at a low-carbon fuel standard for Oregon. And today we're reporting to the legislature on that work, as we've been directed to do by the legislation that was passed in 2009. A full report of that work was delivered this morning by email to everyone. There's a two-pager that has a link to the full report for your reference, and we were directed to do that as well. So just letting you know that that was done today. So very briefly, what is a low-carbon fuel standard? So each type of transportation fuel, whether it be gasoline, diesel, natural gas, or the like, contains carbon in various amounts. And this is also known as the carbon content of fuel. When the fuel is burned, that carbon turns into carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas. The lower the carbon content of fuel, it's logic that the fewer greenhouse gas emissions would be produced by burning that. So the basis for the legislation was that transportation sources represented about a third of the greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. Around the framework of the legislation, a low-carbon fuel standard could be an important strategy to reduce greenhouse gases from this sector. Another key important part of this legislation was to ensure an important economic benefit is shown for a low-carbon fuel standard, such as promoting biomass production within the state and other economic development projects that might occur around a standard like this. What we're asked what the bill also said in was to us to look at a 10-year period by which a low-carbon fuel standard would reduce the emissions from burning of fuel, transportation fuel, by 10% over a 10-year period. So that's the analysis that we undertook. And there's two standards, potential standards that we looked at. One is for gasoline and its substitutes, and one is for diesel and its substitutes. Also, the legislature in 2009 asked DEQ to proceed with the utmost caution, that we are to engage stakeholders in a stakeholder process and the public and keep this body informed. Today, we're certainly reporting on the work to date and in our work with the diverse advisory committee that we've had over the last year, and obviously we're reporting to you. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Andy Ginsberg to give some of the framework, and then Michael will talk about some of the economic analysis that we did, and then I'll wrap up in terms of next steps.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, co-chairs Cannon and Gilliam. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ, and I don't know how to have the projector go on to the screen. Could the committee administrator help us with that?
Yeah, we've got a gas fire down.
Great. Okay. Apparently, nor do I know how to advance the. Okay, great, thank you. Okay, so I'd like to just begin with a brief recap of House Bill 2186, which authorized the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt a low-carbon fuel standard. The bill required DEQ to evaluate the costs and benefits of a low-carbon fuel standard and to design the most efficient program. As Dick mentioned, the goal of the program would be to reduce the average carbon intensity of Oregon's transportation fuels by 10% over a 10-year period. And so just briefly, the carbon intensity has to do with the greenhouse gas emissions over the life cycle of a fuel per unit of fuel energy. So it's not a cap on the total greenhouse gas emissions from fuel or a cap on the total amount of fuel that can be sold, but rather it's a standard that applies to each unit of fuel, each gallon or each unit of fuel energy. The bill directed DEQ to design the program using a life cycle approach. That means we'd be looking at the emissions from production of the fuel all the way to combustion, and to adjust that for the amount of energy that's in a unit of fuel, and also to adjust it for the efficiency of vehicles, so that we can have an apples to apples fair comparison of one fuel to another. It also directed DEQ to look at flexible approaches to implementation, and also, importantly, to include safeguards for consumers and businesses, as Dick mentioned. So in the next few slides, I'm just going to briefly summarize the our recommendations for the program and highlight some of the key aspects of our proposal. And hopefully I can make this advance again. I don't know. There we go. Okay, so we actually went forward too far. So I'll just tell you that we had an advisory committee that included 29 members, and it was a diverse committee, including supporters of the program as well as those who have concerns about the program. The committee met 13 times over 13 months, and these were mostly all-day meetings, so we had a very robust discussion about numerous policy and technical issues that we resolved in coming up with our recommendations. And I'll just want to thank the committee members for their hard work and helping us to provide input on the design of the program. And also note that the committee was able to reach consensus on many of the issues that we were considering. Not all issues, but many issues we did reach consensus on. But the report is DEQ's recommendation and certainly does not speak for the position or views of any individual member of the committee. You could advance that since I think you know how. Okay. this slide illustrates what we mean by a life cycle approach. And so if we start on the left, we've got the production of the fuel. And so in the case of a petroleum fuel, maybe it's an oil well. In the case of a biofuel, maybe it's a farm. But there are greenhouse gas emissions that occur at that first stage when the fuel is being produced. And then as we move across to the right on this picture, the next step would be refining. There are emissions that occur during the refining process, and transportation, and then on to storage, and finally combustion, and in a vehicle. And so although we usually think of most of the emissions occurring at the combustion stage, for some fuels, more emissions actually occur during the production, refining, and storage stage, so that in order to really tell if we're getting a net benefit by substituting one fuel for another, we really have to look at the emissions over the entire life cycle. You'll also note on the left of the screen, at the bottom, we've got indirect effects. That's not a very good picture of a forest fire, and it's supposed to indicate that In this case, if we take land that's currently in forest and we clear it to grow crops that will be used for biofuels, that's actually going to increase carbon emissions. And so that type of indirect effect would count against a biofuel or a fuel that resulted in that type of effect. On the other hand, if you look above the refinery, we have the potential for generating co-products. So after the fuel is made, what's left over in this case could become animal feed. That would offset other animal feed, which itself would have had greenhouse gas emissions, and so that's a net benefit. So we look at indirect effects, we look at co-products, all of the effects of a fuel all the way from the beginning to the end in order to get the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions. And the net result is then we come up with a carbon intensity value for each fuel. So each fuel has a unique life cycle carbon intensity value that can be utilized. Can we advance that, please? So this slide shows the low carbon fuel standard that we would propose for gasoline and its substitutes, and we have a similar but separate schedule that would apply for diesel and its substitutes. So we are proposing two separate standards, one for gasoline and one for diesel, and the purpose of that is to encourage advances in the carbon content in both types of fuels. So let me just walk through this chart a little bit. Each bar represents the carbon intensity goal for a particular year. So as we move across from the left to the right, the program continues so that at year zero, we're beginning with the carbon intensity that's in fuel today. Gasoline by itself could meet the standard in year zero. And then as we move across to the right in the chart, each year the goal gets a little bit tighter until by year 10, we've reduced the carbon intensity for each unit of fuel by 10%, and it would have to be met by blending in lower carbon fuels or substituting lower carbon fuels for gasoline. You'll also note that the first 2 years are record keeping and reporting only. The goal of that is so that we can get our systems in place and do the outreach and assistance and get ready for the program, so the first compliance year would actually happen in year two. And you'll note also that the reductions in the first several years are very modest, only 0.5% or 1% reduction, and then they accelerate towards the end. And the reason for that is to allow time for the development of new low carbon fuels, particularly the construction of new biofuels facilities, hopefully in Oregon, that would supply the low-carbon fuel that's needed. So it's what we call a backloaded schedule, most of the reductions happening towards the end. The other important thing to note is that in order to simplify administration of the program as much as possible, the program would apply to as high in the fuel distribution chain as we can. So in the case of gasoline and diesel, we have no refineries in Oregon, so the first business that handles gasoline and diesel would be the petroleum importers, and so the rule would apply to them. For biofuels, we do have some producers in Oregon, and we also import, so the rule would apply to the first producer or importer in Oregon. And then for other fuels like electricity or natural gas, which are used largely for non-transportation purposes but could be used for transportation, the rule would apply to the first business that converts the energy into transportation use. So it's high up in the distribution cycle and to affect the minimum number of businesses. As Dick mentioned, a number of safeguards have been built into the program, and the program has been designed, as I mentioned, with a backloaded schedule so that there should be adequate low-carbon fuel in order to meet the standard. But we want to make sure that that's the case, and we've built in safeguards to ensure that we don't end up with any supply disruptions or any impact on fuel prices, or negative impact on fuel prices. So beginning in the top row are the exemptions. House Bill 2186 exempted some specific fuels, for example, propane, even though it is a low-carbon fuel, is exempted because it's very low-volume use in transportation. We would exempt also specific uses of fuels. House Bill 2186 specifically exempts fuel that's used in farm trucks and also in log trucks. We would also propose to exempt fuel used in rail, aviation, and international marine. And then We have a number of other exemptions, for example, small volume production, so fuel that when you look at the amount made by all producers together is in low volume would be exempt. Fuel that's produced for someone's own use would not be covered, and then pilot facilities so that if someone is developing a new low carbon fuel, they would decide when they want to opt, when they're ready to opt into the program for the benefits, but they wouldn't have to deal with the administration early on. Then as we move to the second row, looking at the deferrals, we have three types of deferrals that we would propose to include in the program. The first, a temporary supply disruption. So here would be a case where unexpectedly an important biofuels plant went down because of a natural disaster or a strike or for some other reason. And in the short term, in the year that we're in, there's a short-term disruption in low-carbon fuel. In that case, DEQ would temporarily suspend the compliance obligation. We would allow the fuel suppliers to continue accruing benefit from purchasing low-carbon fuel so that there would be always demand for the product, but they wouldn't have to show compliance in a year where there's a supply interruption. The second deferral would be for a forecasted supply, inadequate supply, and in this case, we'd be looking ahead, and we know that a particular low-carbon fuel production facility was supposed to come online in year 5. It's behind schedule. It's not going to come online until year 7, and we would adjust the compliance schedule to accommodate that so that we wouldn't have a situation where there's not enough low-carbon fuel. And then the final backstop would be the fuel price deferral, where we look at the price of fuel, gasoline and diesel, transportation fuel in Oregon, compared to the price in neighboring states, and if the difference is significant, then and if the difference is caused by the low carbon fuel standard, then again we would defer the requirements until we were able to get the price back under control. As I mentioned, these deferrals we think are very unlikely to ever have to be triggered because the program is designed with a backloaded schedule and it's designed so that there would be adequate fuel supplies. But all these deferrals were built in as safeguards to ensure that we wouldn't have any problems.
Andy?
The last, yes?
Could you just move the microphone a little bit away? We're getting a little stuck.
Further away, like
yeah.
That? Okay.
Thank you.
The last row in this slide has to do with review of the rules. And we would recommend building in a regular annual review to keep the rules current, and then also, as we get about halfway into the program, to have a thorough review so we can see what other states are doing. Where's California? Where are the Northeast states? Where's Washington? Where's EPA? Where's the technology? What more do we know about life cycle analysis, and do a thorough update at that point? So the final slide I have before I turn it over to Michael is to give you some information about how compliance would occur with this program. This slide shows some of the most common fuels, and it also shows the carbon intensity values for those fuels. There are many other fuels with their specific carbon intensity values, but here's some examples. And as you can see, gasoline, for example, at 92, that would be the standard for year 0, and then the standard would decline over time so that some of the lower carbon fuels would have to be blended or substituted in order to meet the standard. Similarly for diesel, starting at 91 and working its way down so that lower carbon fuels would have to be blended or substituted. You also note that some of the biofuels, for example, you can see corn ethanol at 64 versus cellulosic ethanol at 15 indicates that it really matters how the fuel is made, what it's made from, where it's made. We'll all define what its carbon intensity value is. The key feature of the low carbon fuel standard is that it does not mandate how a fuel supplier will comply. It allows all of these fuels to be used in any combination, and it's the suppliers would determine the mix based on the availability of these fuels, their carbon intensity value, and their price, and they would decide how they would comply. And so as technology evolves and as different fuels become available, they can take advantage of those fuels. We're not locked into any particular method of compliance. That's one of the benefits of the program because it's extremely flexible. It creates a challenge for us in conducting the economic analysis because we can't say exactly which fuels will be used. So in order to do the economic analysis, we had to come up with what we call compliance scenarios. So we had 8 different scenarios with 8 different possible ways that fuel suppliers could comply with this, and these scenarios were designed to bound what is likely to happen. So the actual compliance will be somewhere in between one of these scenarios or several of these scenarios. We looked at scenarios that rely primarily on biofuels, other scenarios that relied primarily on advanced low-carbon biofuels. We looked at scenarios that relied more on electricity and natural gas. We had scenarios that considered what would happen if petroleum prices were very high versus very low. Some scenarios where we looked at whether the indirect effects were included or not, and so forth, so that we have all possible combinations included. And then we asked Michael and his firm to do an analysis of the costs and benefits of each of those scenarios. And so with that, I would like to introduce Michael, and first also to mention that House Bill 2186 did require us as part of this analysis to do an economic analysis and to evaluate the analyses that have been done by other states. And we were fortunate to receive a federal grant for this work. So we were able to hire Jack Fawcett Associates, for which Michael is the president. And we were also able to coordinate with Washington to keep the cost down. So we both hired the same consultant and conducted a coordinated study. Michael, as I mentioned, is the president of JFA. He specializes in energy and transportation, he has focused on measuring the impacts of transportation carbon policy for federal, state, and local decision makers. He has experience working in Oregon before. He's done the economic analysis for the highway cost allocation studies. He's also worked on the economic analysis of trade through Oregon's ports and for the impacts of flood control in Oregon. And in addition, as I mentioned, he did the economic analysis for Washington's low carbon fuel standard and has done assessments of climate action plans for states throughout the country. So with that, I'd like to introduce Michael.
For the record, my name is Michael Lawrence. Chairman Dingfelder, Cannon, and Gilliam, I'm here today to tell you about a study we've just completed to estimate the macroeconomic impacts of the low-carbon fuel standard. Our research team was headed by my firm, and we had support from in economic modeling from the Remy Northwest and TIAX LLC. We also had external macroeconomic peer review conducted by Professors Adam Rose and Dan Way from the University of Southern California. This is a very unusual rule. Normally when we're looking at environmental rules, we're seeking to estimate the benefits by looking at hard-to-quantify health effects and quality of living standards. In this case, we have a different circumstance. We have an opportunity for Oregon because this rule provides economic benefits and vitality to the economic system in the state of Oregon. In this project, we looked at various measures of economic activity and economic benefits. So we measured the change in fuel expenditures for the citizens of the state of Oregon, increases in state gross state product, personal income, and the creation of jobs. This low-carbon fuel state standard is actually an economic development program. This occurs because the large economic losses incurred by the U.S. and Oregon economies caused by importing petroleum to fuel our cars, trucks, households, and industry. In 2008, it was estimated that our oil imports cost the U.S. economy $500 billion in wealth transfers from oil consumers to oil producers and in reduced GDP. In Oregon, we import virtually all of our transportation fuels. Economists are taught from the start that there is no free lunch. But in this case, replacing imported petroleum with locally produced fuel helps to avoid part of those economic losses. The low-carbon fuel standard will replace a limited amount of petroleum with lower-carbon fuels that can be produced right here in Oregon. In the study, we compare those economic variables and the performance of some 70 individual economic sectors over the next 12 years with and without the low carbon fuel standard. The study covers both statewide and specific industries such as construction, agriculture, and petroleum distribution. To conduct this analysis, we relied on a series of economic models that are used throughout the country to do the same kind of analysis. The Vision Economic Microeconomic Model, which keeps track of our vehicle fleet over time as new technologies enter the fleet, was developed by the Argonne National Laboratory for the U.S. Department of Energy and is regularly updated. The REMI Policy Insight Model, developed by Regional Economic Models, Inc., is the most commonly used macroeconomic model in the country for public policy analysis. In fact, these two models together, Vision and REMI PI Plus, have been used to analyze the impacts of low carbon fuel standards in Washington, in California, and in the Northeast states, and all of these studies have produced similar results to the ones we're talking about today. I'll try to change that. It's a challenge. I went too far. Okay. Or no, that's the correct one. That's the right one. Okay. Excuse me. Business as usual. That's our base case. And all of these analyses, we're looking at the economic impacts as a difference from a base case. So we're not trying to forecast the future here. We're trying to understand how the future might change as a result of a change in our fuel supply. That is a lot easier task for economists. We don't like to forecast things 10 or 12 years in the future because we know we're going to be wrong. In this case, the scenario analysis for each low-carbon fuel standard is compared to the business-as-usual case. In this particular graph, we see the change in carbon intensity over the analysis period from 2010 to 2022. And we see that the carbon intensity is already going down. This is a result of the federal renewable fuel standard and the clean car standards here in Oregon and the national standards. So from 2010 to 2022, you can see from this graph that the fuel intensity of gasoline will fall by 2.7%. That leaves 7.3% still to be achieved in order to achieve the state goal of 10%. That gap will be made up by the low carbon fuel standard. In diesel fuel, the reductions are slightly greater, with 5.8% expected from the federal and existing standards, and the low carbon fuel standard picking up the balance of the 4.2%.
Find a way to do
it
cheaper than
what
the state
is going
to give them
the money. It changes when it wants to, I think. Here we go. This slide shows the distribution of fuel consumed in 2022 in the business as usual case and in one of our eight scenarios. The particular scenario we're looking at here is a scenario with high electric vehicle use and high natural gas use. As you can see, the difference between business as usual and the scenario case are not substantial in any way. The petroleum will still dominate our Oregon fuel market, yet the slight changes in the fuel mix composition will result in our achieving the 10% goal established by the state. In fact, each of the scenarios achieves that 10% reduction in carbon intensity. I'd like to note a couple of the changes here. You note that biodiesel in 2022 in the scenario is actually lower than the predicted business as usual case. This is a result of more natural gas being used in heavy duty vehicles. I should also point out that the fuel we're using today is not the same as the fuel we'll be using in 2022. That while we call both those biodiesel, for example, the biodiesel fuel will be much cleaner and more useful in the future than it is today. There's been some issues about the warranties associated with heavy-duty engines and biodiesel mixes. The ASTM, the National Standards Association, in 2008 adopted a new standard for biodiesel. And currently manufacturers are in the process of adopting that standard so that biodiesel mixes up to 20% will meet all manufacturer warranties. Oh, I did it. Okay. And this slide depicts the model results for gross national product. Gross national product is a measure of economic activity in the state of Oregon. We could have shown personal income or employment or other measures. They would look about the same on this graph. What we see is a cluster of our scenarios all looking about the same. And in each of these scenarios, we're looking at some differences. The committee developed scenarios where we were looking at high petroleum prices in the future and compare them to lower petroleum prices. It looked at cases where we were looking at indirect land use impacts and cases where we were not looking at indirect land use impacts and cases where we were looking at a single pool for all fuel or a dual pool, one for gasoline and one for diesel. In all of these cases, the results that we see in the macroeconomic modeling are very similar. All eight cases produce one startling effect. They're all positive. They all result in positive economic activity in the state of Oregon. The highest case, the high electric vehicle and natural gas case, starts producing benefits earlier because the electric vehicle use starts earlier than ethanol vehicle use and the investments associated with ethanol. So the high EV and natural gas case produces the highest benefits. The cluster and the peak there is the investment in biofuels facilities in the state of Oregon to produce fuel for the Oregon fuel market. The low case, the lowest impact case, is a case where the committee asked to look at a situation where all of the alternative fuels used in Oregon were imported. There was no additional biofuel production in the state of Oregon caused by the low carbon fuel standard. Again, the economic benefits that we talked about before, increases in personal income, lower fuel costs, resulted in economic benefits for this case as well. This chart shows the change in fuel expenditures from the base case. So for each of the eight scenarios, we looked at the expenditures that would be expected by Oregon households and businesses for fuel, and then we compared that to the alternative case in which the fuel mix changed. And in all eight cases, we found that the expenditures for fuel in the state of Oregon would be reduced as a result of this low-carbon fuel standard. Now, that's a little bit of a surprising result, and we might ask ourselves, how could that happen? And part of it is because what we're doing here is comparing the expenditures in the base case, where we're talking about primarily petroleum fuel consumption, and in the alternative case, where some of that petroleum fuel is now being replaced by a lower carbon fuel. We all know what's been happening to fuel prices. I think the petroleum barrel of petroleum just went over $100 a barrel the other day again. We've all experienced the high fuel prices over the last 5 or 6 years. $4 a gallon for gasoline is not surprising to most people anymore. And over time, what we find is that these high prices are caused by control of the worldwide supply of petroleum by the Organization of Petroleum Producing Countries. They currently control about half of the world's resources in petroleum, and it is predicted by the U.S. Department of Energy that their control of the world's petroleum resources will grow over the next two decades up to about 55 or 56%, and most of us don't expect that they will be lowering the prices very soon. So we have a circumstance where we're using high-priced fuel today, we're importing that fuel, paying economic consequences as a result of those imports of fuel, and we're replacing it with products that are produced in Oregon, possibly, are less expensive than petroleum, and results in households spending less for their fuel. In addition, we're talking about fuels like electric power, which is electric vehicles are 3 to 4 times more efficient than internal combustion vehicles, gasoline-powered vehicles. You've all seen the ads probably for the Volt, the new electric vehicle from General Motors, which is talked about of getting over 100 miles on a gallon of fuel. Also, electric power is less expensive than petroleum today for driving a vehicle, and natural gas in heavy trucks is actually less expensive than diesel fuel today. So as we look over the entire analysis period from 2012 to 2022, and we add up all of the impacts over that period, we find that the in employment we're talking about from just under 100 to 29,000 job years in Oregon as a result of the low carbon fuel standard. This occurs primarily because of the construction of ethanol plants in the state and the construction of new infrastructure to allow electric vehicle charging and natural gas refilling within the state. These investments occur in Oregon, and we've made an assumption here that the investments from the fuel industry are coming from outside of Oregon. Personal income in this case, we show benefits of a $2.6 billion increase in personal income as a result of the program. A gross rate product increases by $2.1 billion, and fuel savings in the order of $1.6 billion. These are substantial. They're very real impacts on the state of Oregon, on households and industries within Oregon, and they result in substantial economic development. And with that, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you. In terms of wrap up, maybe grab the next slide. So going back to what in this legislation that was passed in the 2000 legislature asked us to go very cautiously. So we're at today, which was delivering the report, which you have to look at, and finishing our advisory committee work. The next step of the process, we're asked to reach out beyond the advisory committee and get broader feedback on what we've put out there, which we intend to do over the next some period of time. And then there's this decision-making point. That decision-making point is whether we go forward with rulemaking or not, and the timing of that rulemaking. And certainly, as you have your the report with you, we welcome any feedback from any of you individually or collectively, and we're going to go forward with reaching out, like I said, beyond the stakeholder group and taking that information and then making a decision on rulemaking. The other thing I would add is that within the bill, there's a sunset in the bill, a 2015 sunset, which basically means the program would go away in 2015. And the reason for that was certainly to ensure that the legislature had an opportunity to look at this down the road, maybe in 2013 or whatever, to determine whether or not keep that sunset in or change that time or lift it and go forward with the program. So with that, that's our presentation, and we'd certainly be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from House members? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it seems like it was a lot longer ago since I saw you guys and got that big report from you, Andy. But I have to ask again, Oregon has one of the lowest carbon footprints in the country. And so why is this necessary for us? Don't we already have a pretty, I mean, we're like 1% or less than 1%?
Chairs, Representative Boone, what I would do is just go back to the legislation. We're asked to look at this and to see if it makes economic sense for Oregon, has an economic opportunity, if you will, if we were to develop a low-carbon fuel standard by either reducing the price of gas or creating jobs, and that became a big part of whether we would do this or not. And a benefit is we reduce greenhouse gas emission, but the real purpose and what we were asked to do from the committee is to really look at the economics of this. Does it make sense for Oregon, and is it good for Oregon in terms of economy and business and that? And so that, if you will, is a big important piece of the decision making.
And I've got a quick follow-up, yeah. And then I think I asked it last time too, and I just want to make sure that when you talk about fuels coming from the Midwest, are you counting in the transportation element of the carbon footprint on that?
And Chair, Representative Boone, absolutely. That's a key element of that life cycle analysis. So we look at the carbon emissions all the way up and down the chain from production through transportation, refining, and ultimately combustion.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any questions over here? Senator Przanski.
Thank you. If you could follow up with my office, if you can't give me the information now. On the ethanol issue, I'm hearing from constituents concerned about the impact of on food. With corn, I know that when we looked at this some years back, Texas A&M had a study out that actually said there was not that impact but now it seems like maybe things have changed as to the cost for and the impact on food. And the other part in relation to that, if we are seeing any movement to other cellulose type of product to be substituted for the use of corn for ethanol.
Chairs and Senator, this is a very important issue and one that the federal government has been focusing on for a number of years. And a recent Department of Agriculture study found that the potential impact of fuel from corn and other crops would not impact the food supply in any way. Partly this is a result of changes in the technologies that have been applied to fuel. These things are evolving, of course, as we speak. They're changing very rapidly. Manufacturers are looking at alternative feedstocks. Many grasses are available that also can be used to produce these products and other products as well. So the impact on the agricultural sector looks to be very small at this point.
I appreciate that. So maybe an industrial hemp, we can actually work that in at some point too, huh?
Sure.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Concerning your financial outlook here, the assumption is on this chart that all of the product is made in Oregon?
Well, not that, Chair and Senator, not that all the product is made in Oregon, but that the result of the essentially guaranteed market for these products in Oregon, that there would be investment in facilities to produce these products in Oregon, and those producers would then use Oregon feedstocks to produce the product and supply it to the Oregon market. There's no assumption that all the product is being produced in Oregon. Oregon will still import biofuels from external places. And one of the scenarios did look at the case in which all of the additional biofuels to meet the standard would be imported.
In your economic assumption, did you also take into effect our increased desire to use biomass for electricity production, so that we have adequate supply of biomass for your product and for energy, the other side of the energy pressure?
Chair, Senator Olson, we looked at the likely availability of low carbon fuels. We did not directly consider the competition for biomass to be used for electricity production as opposed to being used for low-carbon fuels, partly because this rule, as Michael said, does not constrain fuel to be produced in Oregon. We're assuming that fuel is going to be available from a wide variety of sources. We're hoping that it will spur economic development within the state, but if it's a higher use to put biomass towards electricity in Oregon, then it will go that way. If it's a higher value to use it for producing biofuels, it will go that way. This rule is basically agnostic on that point.
One more. Thank you for that answer. My concern is that if we get into this biomass fight and we have supply and demand, the demand for the biomass is going to be so great as it is in recycled newsprint that our economy can't handle it, and the gas prices go so high our citizens can't handle it, and then your entire financial economic assumption is out the window.
If I might, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that's a great observation. That's one of the reasons we did build the deferral in. If the result was a higher price at the pump, that it defers the program so it doesn't produce that unintended consequence.
And one more. I'm sorry. Then how does that affect your economic model then, if you defer the system?
Well, the benefits that we're talking about today were those, assuming that some production for 7 of the 8 scenarios, that some production of biofuel products were undertaken in Oregon and provided by Oregon investment. So some of those, if that did not occur, as in scenario H, I believe, all of the product required would be imported, and many of those economic benefits associated with the production of the fuel would go away. You still have the economic benefits associated with the lower cost product, and the stimulation of the economy that would provide.
Actually, I have one question before we go over to Representative Benz that sort of follows up on that line of thought, or line of questioning. And I haven't had a chance. I do know that it was delivered to my inbox, and I haven't had a chance to look through the entire report, so this may be in there. As a follow-up to that, what is the percentage right now of fuels or biofuels that we're actually producing in state versus what the potential is, the maximum potential through any of these scenarios? So right now, I'm assuming that the percentage is very, very low, but I want to ask the expert, and then if you can tell me what would be the highest potential through any of the scenarios for production in state.
I don't have that number in front of me, Senator, but I can provide that number for you.
Okay.
Right now, it's extremely small. It's a new industry in Oregon and one that is hoping to grow, but at this point, there's very little fuel production in Oregon, but biofuel production in Oregon. But it's expected under these programs that with the guaranteed market, the production would occur.
Okay. And just to follow up, the majority of our fuels that are being imported from whether it's Canada or other areas, where the majority right now, are we still getting the majority of our fuels from Canada? Is that still the case?
Most current imports in the U.S. are coming from Canada and Mexico, mm-hmm. But we do get product from around the world.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm just curious, if this is such a great thing, why it hasn't happened all on its own? Is it simply a matter of a prompt, or is there some gargantuan conspiracy that's called the market forces that are preventing this from happening? Why hasn't this already happened if it would make us so many billions of dollars?
That's a great question, Senator, mm-hmm. Chairs and Representative. We have an unusual situation here, and that is that we're importing an enormous amount of petroleum from outside the country, and every day we import petroleum, we're sending resources overseas, which is an economic cost to the country. In order to have these fuels included in our fuel supply, the investors need the assurance that they would indeed have a market, because these fuels would primarily be blended in the existing fuel stock. Investors believe that those investments would not be wise without some guarantee. The low carbon fuel standard provides them a guarantee of a market for these products, and that's why they might come on. At the same time, we are moving very quickly with new technology for transportation and electric vehicles. We all see the commercials now for the Volt and the Leaf and the other electric vehicles that are becoming available to us with equivalents of 100, 120 miles per gallon gasoline equivalent. So we are, in fact, moving in this direction already with these investments, and I don't think it's any conspiracy. It's just the market operating the way one would expect it to do.
The reason, from my very, very shallow study of this, that one wonders how this would work, is that Oregon would be an island trying to create this situation. And I fear we'd be pretty much an isolated, abandoned desert island as all our economic activity went elsewhere, as if the world's fuel prices remained low. So I don't see how this can work with just Oregon doing it. And because I look at the thought here, it says significant investment of lower carbon fuel production capacity and distribution infrastructure will be needed. That needs to come here for some reason, and that generally means that there's an economic prompt, and that generally means there isn't a cheaper alternative. And so I'm wondering, how can Oregon go this alone?
Well, Oregon is not actually going it alone. California already has a low-carbon fuel standard in place. The state of Washington is in the process of evaluating a low-carbon fuel standard themselves. So one could envision the whole West Coast, for example, having such a standard. The Northeast states are also in the process of evaluating a low-carbon fuel standard for all of those states. There has been also discussion of a national low-carbon fuel standard, but that's my understanding is that is not on the table in any of the current legislation in Washington.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Cannon. I wish our colleague Jules Bailey was here today, because he suggested that we eliminate the Department of Energy. And after hearing your presentation, I think we have a possibility here of combining Business Oregon with the kind of outlook that you've given us with the Department of environmental quality, or eliminating one of them, and I would leave that up to Mr. McCabe or our director, Peterson, to decide. But wow, I mean, this is a very rosy, positive picture. So you've mentioned several of our neighbors. So my question would be for anybody that wants to respond regarding our neighbors. It's my understanding we get most of our fuel from Washington and Idaho right now, and Washington has backed way off of this, and I think out of concern. If anybody's got a Seattle joke now, they're welcome to throw that in. Okay. Never mind. But they've backed off of this. That's where we get a lot of our fuel. Speaking of neighbors in California, which we've evoked their great example, we are not as big as California, so I know it's apples and oranges, but how many FTEs does California have currently to try to, you know, implement their low carbon standard? And how many, you know, we've got a half now, I think you've reported to me before. The costs of this, and by our neighbors' experience, Idaho, Washington, and California, make me very suspicious of a, not necessarily of a model, but of a quick fix to the Oregon economy. And I know, and I appreciate you addressing the fact that we said to you, we want to know about jobs and costs, but this seems way out ahead of where Oregon is today.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I mean, part of the reason when I said that the legislature asked us to go very cautiously was to present this to you so that you could take a look and certainly give us advice or feedback like you're doing today, for us to take an expanded look in reaching out outside of our advisory committee, who raised a lot of the same concerns and issues in this economic analysis, to decide how or if we go forward with rulemaking. I mean, that's part of it. And so I think the questions that you're asking now in terms of highlighting that caution that the 2009 legislature asked us, do we need to explore. And again, as I said, there is the sunset issue in the bill, which effectively says, you know, if we're going to go forward, it's going to end in 2015. And so we're going to have to make some decision before then about whether it's valuable to go forward with a rule and implementing a rule based on that. So I guess my answer to that is just, you know, we're taking that go cautious seriously, and your questions are important to us to answer and try to feed into so that we can make that decision in terms of moving forward.
One quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. I had a lot in there, I know, but can you, just one example, specifically, can you speak to our neighbor to the north who has backed off of these standards for fear of the cost?
Co-Chair Gilliam, first let me say that the first part of your question had to do with the importing of fuel to Oregon from Washington and from other states. And one thing to note is that for the most part, compliance with the low carbon fuel standard wouldn't happen at the other state. The gasoline and diesel would still be imported to Oregon, and then low carbon fuels would either be blended or substituted here. So we're not dependent on other states to make changes in order for the program to work. My understanding is that we conducted our evaluation of the low carbon fuel standard in parallel with Washington's evaluation. And as I mentioned, we utilize the same consulting support. Washington has completed their evaluation. The Department of Ecology has not yet made its formal recommendation to Governor Gregoire about how they're going to proceed. They got the same results that we got. Even though they have refineries in Washington, they still got a very positive economic result, a very positive environmental outcome from this program. And so we haven't seen yet whether or not what they're going to recommend in terms of Washington going forward, but they're seeing the same results that we're seeing in terms of very positive.
Okay, one more. I'm so sorry.
No, you gotta go.
But just to be sure here, you're saying that you don't have the same image that I have or information that I have, that Washington's not going to do this out of fear of the cost that it's going to require. You're saying that they very much are in the game.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Gilliam, We'll check that out and come back to you with a response from Washington to see where they are affirmatively. We'll do
I'm
that for sure.
To see
yeah.
where the
oh yeah no I mean I think we'll check that out and see exactly where we hear they're at and then bring that back to
them. Mr. Co-Chair, I was on the phone with my counterpart up in Washington last night, and we'll be talking to him again, and I will check with him. I apologize because our committee needs to go back to our hearing room to do some business on bills, so we're going to have to adjourn our half, but I just wanted to make a comment before we leave. I first want to thank, I know there's many people in this room who have worked very hard on this advisory committee, and we thank you for that work, and I will look forward to hearing more about this, and possibly we'll have other hearings in our committee down the road. I apologize that we have other bills that need to be heard, so we have people waiting for us, but I do think that given the current and I think probably future situation in the Middle East, that the, and I don't know if any of your scenarios, because you can't really plan for the type of changes that are going on right now. I think that if anything, we're going to see more and more competition for the fuel that we're currently importing from Mexico and Canada, and I think that there may be even the need to look at future scenarios given the change in the world economy and the incredible, you know, pressures that are being put on the existing fuel sources. So I don't know if that's possible to look at some additional scenarios given the change in the political situation in the Middle East, but I think that if anything, we don't even know how stable that supply is. We don't know how available that supply is going to be. We don't know if the Suez Canal is going to be open on a continual basis and how that's going to play out. So I think that the world forces are changing and possibly changing the demand for the supplies that are coming into the United States and could have future implications for a small state like Oregon, given we don't have a lot of control over those sources. So appreciate the work that you're doing. We'll look forward to hearing more. And thank you for inviting us here today. Apologize, we have to go do some business.
Thanks, Senator. So we have two other panels. I know Representative.
I'm going to adjourn the Senate portion of this informational hearing.
Thanks for being with us. I know Representative Krieger had a question that we can bring up.
Yes, you know, twice you used the term government guaranteeing a market, government's guaranteeing a market. I wish they'd do that in the timber industry and all the other industry we got. I don't see that happening long term. To me, it looks like a Ponzi scheme. And then I get to thinking of all these electric cars you want to have out there. That's not going to work, except for maybe in the metro areas. You're going to spend more time with wreckers carrying these white little cars with batteries before they ran out on the freeways and back roads. I'm waiting to see it if I live that long.
I don't know if there was a question in there. I don't see a response coming.
I'm dubious at the least. In my old age, I'm cautious.
I hear you.
Why is that?
Well, thank you very much. Are you going to be able to stick around if committee members want to bring them up, assuming there's time? Again, we could perhaps ask them to do so. But we'll plan to hear next and last from two panels. First, we'll include Bob Russell, Craig Campbell. Marcy Putnam was invited to be a part of this panel as well with IBEW. Due to the weather, we have written testimony only, but it is in your packet, member, so I did draw your attention and draw the attention of the record to the written testimony provided by Marcy Putnam from IBEW. Gentlemen, in whatever way you prefer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA Oregon-Idaho. I'll point out that we were a member of the stakeholder process in the advisory committee. I'd also indicate that, in general, AAA is very supportive of the idea of trying to meet the transportation-oriented need for greenhouse gas reduction and have been involved in several different groups that are looking at a variety of different ways of reducing that footprint. My reason to come here before you today is to primarily talk to you about process. We're involved in a process currently with the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Department of Land Conservation and Development to take a look at ways of reducing greenhouse gas emissions as a result of land use decisions and a variety of other things that can be done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles. One of the things that we noted in this process is that this process that was used by DEQ was significantly different in a couple of ways. One is it started with an end result in mind, and the process that they went through, though robust in the amount of time that was taken, predominantly was filled with providing a vast amount of information to the members and was not as inclusive and robust in that way that we've experienced with the DEQ and, or I'm sorry, with the ODOT and LCDC process. Our concern is, and this is really more as a result of the presentation that I just saw, our members are the ones that will be adversely affected if the estimation about the fuel cost goes up. And we want to make sure that everything is taken into account in determining what the end result of the low carbon fuel standard should be. My recommendation, quite frankly, is that I know we have a time frame that we need to meet in order to achieve our 2025 goals for CO2 emission reductions, but quite frankly, suspending DEQ's rulemaking process until they can go through the kind of robust and interrelated activity that we've seen with the ODOT and LCDC process, I think, is in order. I know that they have attempted to put some safeguards in place, for instance, the deferral. The problem is it takes 4 months for that to get into place. And when you have members that are trying to make ends meet in this economic environment, and they have to wait 4 months before an increase in their fuel costs goes up, that's problematic, especially when we just spent a large portion of last session discussing what the impact of 6 cents on their gas tax would be. But again, we want this to be a successful process, and if we do it wrong at the outset and we trip at the starting gate, it will be years before we can re-engage a meaningful discussion about how to deal with the low-carbon fuel standard and do it properly. So we aren't concerned about the idea of going forward with this idea, but we want to make sure it's done right. And our concern is we seem to be rushing to a specific end result. And some of it, as I think was mentioned earlier, seems a little too rosy, and I think it would benefit from a more robust and inclusive discussion where the people were not advisory, but were actually coming up with a solution that came out the other end. And with that, I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thanks. Let's hear from Mr. Russell and then take questions for either.
Mr. Chair, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. It's a pleasure to be here before you today. 2 years ago, I actually testified before this committee on House Bill 2186, and at that time, I very much was opposed to the low carbon fuel standard. During the 2 year period, I've learned a whole lot more, and quite frankly, I'm even more opposed today than I was 2 years ago, as I believe that this is the wrong policy choice for the state of Oregon. And recognize we're talking about a lot of things today as if there were some certainty around them, but in fact, there isn't any. There is no state that has done a low carbon fuel standard beginning to end. California's program went into effect in January. Last year, there was a reporting year. All they asked was folks to report. So the impacts of their low carbon fuel standard have not been felt in California. The other states that we've talked about, Washington and the northeastern states, they're still considering whether or not they even want to go down this path. So with that great deal of uncertainty, particularly within an industry that's very dependent on its fuel supply, you can understand my concern and skepticism about some of the things that we've talked about. I was also on the task force, and I attended almost every meeting, and most of the meetings were all day long, and I would like to propose that we introduce legislation that declares that all day meetings are cruel and inhuman punishment. I mean, it was really difficult to sit still for that long and listen to all this stuff. But through that process, I learned a lot. And basically, there's three things that we can do to reduce the carbon from the transportation sector. We can reduce the carbon in the fuels, which is biofuels.
and we can make the vehicles more efficient, or we can use them less so that we are consuming less fuel. And the third thing we can do is, through technological change, we can change the way that we propel the vehicles. And all three are important, but in a few minutes I'll tell you why I think we're going down the wrong policy path today. And the low carbon fuel standard, I think one thing that's very important, its success is predicated on fuels that are not commercially available today. You heard mention of the cellulosic conversion for fuels. That is something that we hope for, but it is not available in the marketplace today where it can produce commercially used quantities of fuel. A part of the LCFS, an idea of it, is that it's a regulatory program that forces technological innovation. And that's why it's backloaded. And because we don't have the things today to meet the goals. And the idea is that we will develop them because we're forced to through this regulatory program. I think that we would all pretty much agree that Midwest corn ethanol, which is where our ethanol comes from today, is not desirable. And I think we would also agree that biodiesel made from soybeans grown in the Midwest is also not desirable. Based on some analysis, those fuels have carbon contents, when you look at the life cycle, that are comparable to the petroleum fuels that we use today. So we've got to do something different in order to meet the goals that we've set for ourselves. One of the flaws that I see in this whole analysis is that there's a belief that the fuels will be locally produced. You heard Michael Lawrence say that his economic analysis was based on locally produced fuels. There is no reason to think that that is going to happen. Right now, as you've heard, our gasoline our petroleum comes from Washington, most of it. And a lot of it is Alaskan crude, not just crude coming from Canada. And our biofuels are coming from the Midwest. The federal government also has a program to reduce the carbon content in fuels. And they are two of the pieces they're trying to address. They have a renewable fuel standard, like we do in Oregon. We already have 10% ethanol and 5% biodiesel. The federal government has a glide path where they are increasingly demanding that we have more biofuels in our transportation fuels. And that's going to drive the marketplace. Representative Bentz asking about the marketplace and how that's going to work. And when the federal government says you got to have millions of gallons of biofuels that you have to sell in the marketplace, and then you compare that to Oregon, a few hundred thousand or whatever it is, it's the federal program that's going to drive the production of fuels. And I do not believe that they are going to be locally produced. I believe that the fuels are going to be produced where the feedstock is actually grown. So that's why we're getting the fuels today, the biofuels from the Midwest, because that's where the feedstock is, that's where the corn is, that's where the soybeans are. And I think that will continue even when we go to cellulosic. It's going to also be where that is most readily available. And I don't believe that it's going to happen in Oregon. When you step back and look at this, there is no way that it cannot increase the cost of fuels. You've got a very complex regulatory program. And someone mentioned that California has a significant number of people involved in their low-carbon fuel standard. And last session, the fiscal impact showed that Oregon was going to have 1.5 FTE. Well, as we go down and implement this program, there is going to be the requirement for more people at DEQ to administer this program. And that's going to be paid for by fees on the participants. That's going to be added to the cost of the fuels. There's also one aspect of this program we didn't talk about yet today, and that is if you cannot meet the standards that will be set based on a glide path to get us to the 2020 goal, and then you have to buy credits. So once you interject that trading system into the marketplace, I mean, really what you're talking about is a cap and trade system for fuels. That whole buying and selling of credits is going to add cost. That doesn't exist today. That's also going to be added to the price of fuels. And the trucking industry is incredibly sensitive to changes in our fuel prices. Today, a gallon of diesel is a little over $3. When we were going through the process on the task force, we talked about diesel being $5. Last session, we passed House Bill 2001, which was the transportation funding package. We increased the weight mile tax by 3 cents a mile. If you increase the price of diesel from $3 to $2, that would increase our cost by 33 cents a mile. We thought 3 cents a mile was a huge tax increase. In fact, the tax increase in 2001 was the largest tax increase of any kind in the history of the state. But compare that to 33 cents and what that will do to Oregon's trucking industry, because we're operating as an island, somebody mentioned earlier. For example, I have members that are moving containers in and out of the Port of Portland every day. There are also trucking companies located in Vancouver, Washington that are doing exactly the same thing. If the price of fuel in Oregon is higher than that in Washington, it is going to force my members to move to Vancouver so that they can get a lower cost fuel. That is not going to be good for Oregon's economy. All that employment is going to move from here to there. Now look at it in the bigger picture. A truck today and can fill up in Portland, Oregon, and go to Chicago. So trucks that are operating interstate or between states, there will be no reason for them to buy fuel in Oregon if it's more expensive. So it's going to be my members that are landlocked in Oregon that this is the only fuel that they have available that will be buying this more expensive fuel. And that will have a huge impact on the economy of the state. We currently transport 75% of the tons of freight in Oregon. If trucking costs go up significantly, it will force some businesses to actually leave the state so they can get reasonable transportation costs. The risks here are very real to our economy and the jobs that we currently have. I mentioned earlier that I didn't think the LCFS was necessary because of the federal government's programs, and I did mention the renewable fuel standard that the federal government has in place. But the federal government is also setting standards for efficiency for automobiles, which we refer to as CAFE standards. They say that the fleet has to achieve a level of whatever it is, 32 miles to the gallon. And they recently increased the CAFE standards, so that reduces the consumption of fuels. President Obama recently issued an executive order and it basically required EPA to do the same thing for heavy trucks, which we strongly support. The federal programs treat all trucking companies equally across the nation. It won't have an adverse impact on the state of Oregon because truckers in Washington and Idaho and California will be impacted in exactly the same way. Finally, you know, just looking at the policy choices from a 30,000-foot level, what is the best way to reduce the carbon from the transportation sector? I happen to be very privileged in that I've been participating on ODOT's Statewide Transportation Policy Committee, and this is chaired by Gail Achterman, the chair of the Transportation Committee. Some of the folks that are on that committee include John Van Landingham from LCDC, Angus Duncan, who's the chair of the Global Warming Commission, Chris Hagerbaumer from the Oregon Environmental Council, Ken Williamson from the Environmental Quality Council, John Ledger from AOI, and I think this is the back of the room, Craig Campbell from AAA, and myself. And I think of all the folks in the room, they all know a whole lot more about this than I do. But this has been a huge part of my education, at least, on this subject. ODOT has a model, a computer model called GreenStep, and in its original iteration, it was a commodity flow model that showed how goods moved around the state. What they've done is taken that and changed it so it can predict the consumption of fuels, so basically it can predict from the transportation sector how much carbon output each segment of the transportation industries will put out in the state. And then Brian Greger, who's developed the model, he's put this nifty interface on it, which is kind of like a video game, and he brought it to one of our meetings. And you've got all these policy levers that you can pull and change, and then you can calculate, the computer calculates, whether or not you're meeting the goals, the 2035 goals that we've set for ourselves, and we're looking on beyond that to 2050. Some of the policy variables that we're looking at, land use planning, transit use, fuel prices, transportation demand management, road capacity, changes in the vehicle fleet, and changing technologies in vehicle propulsion systems. Remember, that was the third way that you could reduce carbon from transportation. What we found when we pulled all these levers is unless you had a high degree of technological innovation in the propulsion systems, you didn't get close. You could take all the rest of them together, and you're not going to hit the goal, including fuels. But if you take that technology forward, then you get to the goal. And the reason I said at the beginning of my testimony that I think we're making the wrong policy choice, I don't think we are investing enough in the technology, which is the thing that will actually get us to the goal. You know, my vision here is cellulosic ethanol and those kinds of fuels and natural gas. That's the bridge to the technological advances in the propulsion systems. We got some real work to do in that area. There is only one place that you can fuel up with natural gas in the state today. That's on Swan Island. And you've got to have a fuel distribution system if we're going to use natural gas. That's something that we need to think about. And beyond that, somebody mentioned the Chevy Volt. Do you know that the Chevy Volt operates very much like a railroad locomotive? A railroad locomotive, the diesel engine, is in fact a generator, and it produces electricity, which goes to the electric traction motors at each wheel and turns the wheel. Well, that's what a Chevy Volt basically is doing. The gasoline engine is producing electricity. You can do that with trucks as well, hybrid trucks. So we could have generators that are running these electric motors that turn our truck wheels. That is far more efficient than the kind of propulsion system that we have today. We've got one of the largest truck manufacturers in the world in Portland, Oregon. We could encourage them to start pursuing this kind of technology. Beyond just the generators themselves, we could start using hydrogen fuel cells to generate the electricity that turns the wheels. And then you have no carbon output. Those are all things that I can see in my lifetime, and which is, I'm getting pretty old, so that's not that far. So what I would suggest is that we suspend the work on the low carbon fuel standard, reevaluate our policy choices. I would strongly recommend that you have Brian Greger and Commissioner Achterman come in and make a presentation on the Green Step model. I mean, it's fascinating and it's incredibly informative. And if we make a change in those policy choices, we can get to the goal. Like Craig said earlier, we both, as the users, trucks and cars, we support the goal. We want to get there. But we're not going to get there with a low-carbon fuel standard, in our opinion. And I know that was much longer than I was supposed to take, but I thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Any questions for Mr. Kenny? You mentioned policy choices, and the policy choice that we've heard we have today includes whether or not to move forward with a program that would create between an estimated 863 and 29,000 jobs, would add $60 million to $2.6 billion of personal income to the state, $70 million to $2.1 billion in additional gross state product. What am I not understanding? It would appear to me, plus a program that has a deferral for if in fact we get in a situation where gas prices are higher in Oregon than in neighboring states, sure. The program sure. is suspended. That's what we've heard. So help me understand why sure. we would not make an economic choice, why we would not make a policy choice to improve the economy of this state by
that the policy that choice said. Is predicated on locally produced fuels. I do not believe that's reality. I've worked with Michael Lawrence for many years. He did the cost allocation study in 2001, and Craig and I both worked with him. He's an outstanding economist. But he's going to build his model based on the assumptions that he's told to put in.
Okay, I'm going to ask him to nod, and I'll read into the record whether one of the scenarios you evaluated included no locally grown fuels, and he is nodding yes, that yes. one of the scenarios that's reflected in the range of numbers that he provided to us includes no locally produced fuels, which I think, as we'll hear from a later guest, is an unlikely scenario, but one that was evaluated.
Okay. And the second thing that you asked was about the deferrals. And while we're at it, we might as well talk about the exemptions for log truckers and for farm vehicles. What we're told, as far as the exemptions are concerned, you know, you're going to get the fuels that you're going to get, and you may get fuels without biofuels in them, and you may not, and it depends on whether the petroleum the fuel distribution system can handle an additional fuel type. So, for example, at your local gas station, they've got so many tanks. If they've got their tanks full, you are not going to have that option available to you. So it may or may not happen. As far as the deferral is concerned, you know, what we thought when we passed 2186 is if the price spiked, we'd get relief. That's what we thought. And when in discussions with DEQ, and it's going to take months before that actually would come to fruition. And the way it was described to us is DEQ would have to do an investigation. They would have to do an analysis to make sure that the low carbon fuel standard was in fact the cause of the price spike. Then they would have to go to the EQC, who would have to issue an order. I mean, that's a long-term process. That's not what we thought we were getting when we talked about a deferral in 2009.
Yeah, I'd be interested in hearing from the department on their interpretation of the language in the law related to the deferral, and you can follow up with the committee at some future point. But I think that's an important point to understand.
Okay.
Did you want to add anything, Mr. Campbell, or anything from
Mr. Chair? And I apologize, I did not refer to Mr. Chair when I started my previous comments. The only comment I would say is, and it just is a level of certainty as to whether or not that will be the economic benefit. If it is, that's fantastic for a state that desperately needs an economic boost. If it is not accurate, then it's one of those, the old adage, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. It's just a level of confidence that the estimated benefit is actually going to be realized. And unfortunately, where we're standing is it's very difficult to know whether or not that's an accurate assessment or not.
Great. Thank you. We will conclude with a panel of three, Carrie Atia, Jana Gastelum, and Robert Grote. Robert is on the phone, and I will make sure, Robert, that your volume is up when the time comes, but I think we'll begin with Ms. Atia or Ms. Gastelum.
Well, Co-Chairs Cannon and Gilliam, distinguished members of the committee, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm the Program Director for Global Warming at the Oregon Environmental Council, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am going to touch on a couple of things related to the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. So the Oregon Environmental Council supported the Low Carbon Fuel Standard back in 2009 because we believe that building a low-carbon economy is where Oregon has a competitive advantage in the future. We currently import all of our transportation fuels, which means we export over $5 billion a year out of state. And if we can redirect even a small portion of those funds to in-state investments, that's a huge win for Oregon. As was mentioned, we're looking at reducing emissions in the transportation sector with a three-pronged strategy. And what I find interesting is that we think it's actually smart to address emissions from a variety of different technology perspectives. So you can enhance the fuel economy of vehicles, you can reduce those vehicle miles traveled, and we can also upgrade our fuels, which is a really great thing to do for a variety of reasons. One, we're wholly dependent on imported oil. Two, our current transportation fuels come with a variety of concerns, including health concerns. Three, we have an opportunity to create jobs here in the state. So I wanted to maybe respond to some of what the previous panel mentioned. So there was a concern about certainty out there in the marketplace, and the only certainty we have really moving forward is that without new policy drivers, we're stuck with oil. That's what we've got. That's what the future holds, and the forecasts are that prices will only increase. That's a certainty that I think policymakers really shouldn't be comfortable with, and we have an opportunity to sort of create new opportunities here in the state. Anytime we delay implementation and innovation, we also delay benefits. And so, as was noted, this program is cautious. It allows time to phase in technologies. But any moment that we delay implementation is a delay of those benefits that were outlined before us. And I think that's something that we should really weigh and consider. Are we willing to push off job creation? Are we willing to push off in-state investments? I also wanted to remind us all that and really applaud the crafters of the low carbon fuel standard who initially came up with the idea. It's a really smart, flexible, market-based mechanism. And what it asks is that the market delivers the lowest cost, lowest carbon fuels first. And it doesn't require specific blending mandates. And in fact, as was mentioned in DEQ's presentation, fuel economy is considered in the credit making. So when Mr. Russell talked about enhancing hybridization of trucks, that kind of program would actually be able to earn credits under the low carbon fuel standard. So the low carbon fuel standard actually can act as a driver for those technology improvements. I also wanted to touch a bit on the process that was used in coming up with recommendations for the program. And here, I really do want to applaud the Department of Environmental Quality for the way they carried out the program review. And I kind of want to say here that oftentimes in the policy world, we set out with kind of grand visions. We say, let's reach for the moon. Let's bring better fuels to Oregon. But the folks who actually have to figure out how to assemble that spaceship are the folks in our state agencies to really figure out the rules of the program. And here I think that they've done a really good job. So as was mentioned, we had 13 meetings. And apparently, to some people, we both had too much time and too little time with the program. But we had a year of input that we were able to provide. It was very well balanced. Regulated industries had an opportunity, special opportunities to present to the entire advisory committee. DEQ specifically asked industry, how would you formulate administration of this program? How would it fit in with existing program reviews? And they wanted to make it as streamlined as possible. And they also offered special workshops on some of the models that were used for key inputs, including for the GREET model. And I believe, and this is showing maybe my sort of nerdly roots, but I believe I was the only advisory committee member to attend that special workshop. So there's plenty of opportunity for input and learning about the program. They also extended the deadline for review of the economic analysis and extended the deadline to make sure that they got full feedback on the program. So I really do want to, again, applaud DEQ for the way they've administered this program and the careful consideration of all the inputs that have gone into it. And that's probably demonstrated by the fact that the overall report, we probably all find something in it that we think could be improved, and that means that it's a very well-balanced document. There are a lot of co-benefits to decreasing carbon in our transportation fuels. I won't maybe go into them now, but they're also included in my written statement. But I do want to point out, I think Senator Brzezinski raised the issue of what do we do about these concerns about food versus fuel? How do we make sure that we keep society stable? And I think if you're really concerned about those questions, we need to look very closely at the specter of climate change. Predictions for climate change show dramatic reductions to global food output and increased burdens on our healthcare system, increased harm to our coastal communities and infrastructure. And so if we're concerned about stability, it makes sense to implement these smart, flexible programs now so that we allow ourselves that time to respond to the threats that are before us. But really, in the end, the low carbon fuel standard is a complete win-win-win for Oregon. It spurs investment in Oregon and creates jobs. It provides environmental and health benefits, and it helps diversify our fuel mix, which is one of the best ways to deal with uncertainty. And that makes Oregon more prosperous and more secure. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Atiyah.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Atiyah, and I'm Director of Public Affairs for ZeaChem, Inc. ZeaChem is a producer of sustainable and economic advanced biofuels and bio-based chemicals. We are using renewable biomass resources, including wood, agricultural crops, and other non-food materials. I had the privilege of testifying before this committee about 2 years ago as ZeaChem was planning to locate its first biorefinery in Boardman, Oregon, and I'm very pleased to update you that the official groundbreaking for our 250,000-gallon per year cellulosic biorefinery was held in June 2010 in Boardman. Construction is currently underway on that facility, and there is a photo of the progress that we're making at that site in the documents that I submitted today. The biorefinery is scheduled to come online later this year, with cellulosic ethanol production beginning in early 2012. ZeaChem strongly supports Oregon's low carbon fuel standard, and as a member of the advisory committee over the past year, ZeaChem was very pleased with the stakeholder process that was balanced and fair in considering a variety of different perspectives. The low carbon fuel standard provides the certainty that ZeaChem and others in this industry need in order to bring alternative fuels to the market, and that is clear long-term policy. The low-carbon fuel standard will diversify the ways in which vehicles are fueled and provide the market opportunity for biofuels producers to locate production facilities here in the state of Oregon. The objective to lower the carbon intensity of fuels over a 10-year period, with the most significant reductions in the later years of the program, really accurately addresses and recognizes the time that it's going to take in order to transform an industry that is as large and as established as transportation fuels. However, we do need to address this issue of the sunset in 2015, and the sooner that we are able to get rid of that sunset and be able to know that this program is going to be able to achieve its goals, the better that is for investing in the facilities that will be needed to achieve our 10% reduction. The economic analysis demonstrates the significant impacts and the positive impacts of this policy, and not surprisingly, we're seeing that the significant and most beneficial benefits occur when we have the suite of production here in the state, all the way through the life cycle, from the feedstock through the value chain to the consumer. ZeaChem has partnered with Portland-based Greenwood Resources to supply woody biomass to our facility, and they have an existing 28,000-acre hybrid poplar tree farm in eastern Oregon. If you've been to that area, you'll see a large, very large acreage of the poplar trees right off of Highway 84. And so having this very tight logistics between the feedstock source and the biofuel facility really is what is going to create the industry here in Oregon. We are going to be using Oregon resources to produce Oregon-based advanced biofuels. We'll also be supplementing the use of the poplar trees with additional resources, mostly agricultural residues, and that includes wheat straw, which is also very prevalent in eastern Oregon. Our technology is feedstock flexible, so that allows us the opportunity to use what is most available in a local area. We have completed a life cycle carbon analysis, and it shows that Zeachem cellulosic ethanol has 94 to 98% less carbon emissions compared to conventional gasoline. In terms of job creation, the 250,000-gallon per year facility currently under construction is going to be creating about 75 construction jobs during that period and approximately 25 full-time operations jobs when the facility begins to come online. There's also an additional benefit of indirect job creation of approximately an additional 200 jobs. We've raised $40 million to date, and we also have assistance through federal and state programs, and it's really allowed us to have a public-private partnership to bring this industry to fruition and get us to commercial production, which, of course, is the ultimate goal. We've received a $25 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy that's supporting the construction of the facility in Boardman, and also have a preliminary certificate for an Oregon Business Energy Tax Credit. Once we have our facility up and in operation in Boardman, we'll move very quickly into commercial production. And we have an option to lease an additional 25 acres at the Port of Morrow next to where we're building our current facility for a first commercial cellulosic biorefinery. We would anticipate that to be on the scale of 25 million gallons per year, so a 100x scale up compared to the facility that we're currently building. And we anticipate that coming online in late 2013 or early 2014. Overall, I'd like to applaud the Oregon Legislature for creating a sustainable and economic transportation industry in Oregon and the leadership of DEQ throughout this process. Zeachem is excited to be a part of the biofuels industry in Oregon, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for being here. We'll go to our last panelist, assuming he's still on the phone. Robert, you've hung on a long time, I think. Are you there?
I'm certainly here. Can you hear me?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, we can. Go ahead with your testimony.
Okay, hi. I'm Robert Grosch, Executive Director of the Northwest Environmental Business Council, and thanks for the opportunity to address the committee and especially for accommodating my need to participate remotely. My organization, NEBC, is a 15-year-old trade association for companies working in the environmental and energy sector. And I also want to begin by saying that as part of DEQ's advisory committee on this effort, I was impressed by the thoroughness and inclusiveness and openness of the department staff as the committee worked through the elements of an LCFS program. They went out of their way to see that all viewpoints were heard and considered. Now, that said, I support moving forward with the LCFS program because I see it as a business opportunity for Oregon, both in terms of economic protection and economic development. Now, regarding economic protection, as we discussed, Oregon has no oil supply and no refineries and is completely dependent on diesel and gasoline fuel imported from outside the state. And this creates a totally unimpeded flow of dollars from Oregon to other states and other countries. And of course, as an example, just this past week, oil prices spiked dramatically due to concerns over disruptive events in the Middle East. As Oregon's going to pay more for gas, money just drains from our economy. I mean, conversely, every dollar that can be spent domestically produced fuel is a dollar that can circulate in the local economy and create local jobs. And in addition, having a diversity of fuel sources creates a buffering effect on price swings. So that's protection. Now, let me talk about economic development and jobs briefly. I mean, Oregon is at an economic disadvantage when it comes to petroleum, but could have an advantage in other transportation fuels, including biofuels and electricity. We already have a nascent biofuels industry that includes companies such as Sequential Biofuels, Pacific Ethanol, and now, as we just heard, Zeachem, which will be producing biofuels from biomass. And biomass is something that Oregon has in abundance. The LCFS also covers electric vehicles, and Oregon has one of the most ambitious and best organized electric vehicle clusters in the country, represented by Drive Oregon, which incidentally was selected for funding by the Oregon Innovation Council. And we already see major infrastructure investments as we prepare for the rollout of electric vehicles in the state. Now, market support is one of the best things the state can provide to attract and cultivate innovation and investment. So by offering the type of long-term demand that an LCFS program will create, companies like ZECAM will want to sell here, to locate here, and to come here to develop new products and technologies. Now, we heard how the economic analysis performed as part of this design process showed a strong upside in net economic activity and jobs. And at the same time, some understandably expressed concern that the LCFS could raise fuel prices and thus be bad for businesses with truck plates. However, I contend that given that the customer cost safety net and other safeguards that DEQ has designed into the proposed program, there is just no scenario where prices would increase as quickly and as sharply as we've seen in just the past month, and that we'll be seeing in the coming months. So as opposed to being a threat, I think the LCFS is actually a hedge against future oil dependence and price volatility. So finally, I do want to join others in pointing out that the sunset date for the initial program needs to be extended. You know, we've talked about how to make it as painless as process as possible. The implementation is gradual, and the impacts pushed out towards the end of the 10-year program period. However, the legislative authorization, which to sunset at the end of 2015, is well short of the time needed to see any results or evaluate the program's effectiveness. So wanted to include that, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Chair Cannon. Thank you for all three, but thank you for being here today. And Ms. Tia, you're headquartered in Colorado, but you have a very Oregon name for some of us, so we're very glad you're here.
Thank you.
But you are a Colorado person.
Born and raised in Portland, now Colorado.
Oh, good for you. Okay, I just want to check on that. And thank goodness you're here, and I'm thrilled by the 75 construction jobs and heartened by 25 jobs. It's not very many, but I'm glad for them when so many places are going the other way. So that's a good thing, and I don't want to diminish that. I don't see quickly how you or your competitors are going to add the kind of jobs that we need. I mean, I just keep going back to this. And I'll get to my question, Mr. Chair, but I have to, I've just flashed in my mind, I sat in here as your vice chair in 08, we had another joint committee, and then Governor Kulongowski came in, and I'm paraphrasing, and he would not accept this paraphrase, by the way, and said, first of all, no questions, that really bugged me, and he said, follow me on the green highway out of this recession. And I am not diminishing anything that he did or the administration accomplished, but it did not take us out of the recession. And I just want to make sure everybody knows this is what I think. Our unemployment figures are not budging. Again, I shouldn't be talking to you because you brought us 25 jobs. People are giving up. I mean, I think even the unemployment numbers. So I'm very concerned about that, and I know everybody else is. We all got job lapel pins, and we're all focused on this. But I want to be really clear. I'm concerned that we're shifting to this not because of its public safety, because of its good for the environment and for a lot of other positive reasons, but that we are hitching our wagon to that star when we are in the middle of this. So I guess really my question would shift to Miss, is it Gastelum?
Gastelum.
Gastelum. Did you mean it when you said if we don't make a, I think I heard you right, if we don't make a public policy decision for low carbon fuel standards, we're stuck with gas. Is that I hear you right?
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam. The beauty of the low carbon fuel standards that in some ways the policy's in place. It was passed in 2009, and now it's just up for rural adoption. So in some ways, what you could do is say, let's let the program play out as it is, and let's let these jobs be created. And to your earlier point, it would be great if any one sector could fix the economy. Transportation is but one of many sectors, and if there are jobs to be created in it, I think we should applaud that and enable that to happen. We do have the renewable fuel standard that is bringing additional biofuels into the market, but the low carbon fuel standard expands that opportunity. Again, it's performance based. It allows electricity. It also allows natural gas to play as well as bio-based fuels. So I think it's a wider opportunity.
My last follow-up, Mr. Chair, is that's a fair answer to my rambling question, but I am very dubious about this. I understand, I agree with some of the things that you say, but for us to apply this standard as an economic recovery plan just doesn't work for me. And that doesn't mean we stop what we're doing in terms of better emissions and all the rest of it. But I have not made the connection between Oregon's unemployment and joblessness and this and low carbon fuel standards as a pathway out. And I also would say that we are not the only answer, and I don't think we're stuck with gas in that sense. I think that the private sector is doing quite a bit, doing the best they can to, on their own, look for other alternatives. And I'd go back to Representative Bentz. If this is as attractive as it has been displayed here today, more private investors, more folks who already are in the energy and transportation energy would be going there and leading us. So I guess we have an opportunity to disagree.
Co-Chair, can I have a moment to
I have one question for you, and then I think we'll wrap up.
As you pointed out, we have 75 construction jobs, about 20 full-time jobs. I'd like to point out again the additional indirect job creation, so where we have 100 direct jobs created by ZEACHEM to build this facility, to operate this facility. We've worked with the Oregon Employment Department to factor then the additional indirect jobs that will support this one facility, and that's an additional 200 jobs. This is the first facility. It's a 250,000 gallon per year demonstration plant. It's the first step, and it allows us to get to commercial production. And that commercial production facility, we anticipate more than 100 construction jobs, over 60 full-time operations jobs, and then, of course, the additional indirect jobs that go along with that. So it is one piece of the solution. We absolutely need every solution that we can find, but we certainly are a solution. Thank you.
Great. I would be interested in knowing, Ms. T, what role the passage of the low carbon fuel standard may have played in ZEACHEM's thinking about where to locate. Obviously, there are a lot of factors. You needed a feedstock that was plentiful and cheap. But I wonder what role the passage of 2186 played, and what, speak again to the sunset and your consideration about commercialization and what keeping or removing that sunset might mean for that.
Co-chairs, the low carbon fuel standard is one factor in locating here in Oregon. There's certainly many others. The location of the feedstock, the site that we have at the Port of Morrow being along the Columbia River, which offers us tremendous opportunities for transportation of our products to market, whether that's by barge, by rail, by truck. The support that the state has shown for this facility and for commercializing our industry here in this state. So there really are a number of factors that go into deciding where to locate a facility. Having this additional low carbon fuel standard lets us know that low carbon fuels are valued, and that comes with an economic benefit associated with it, especially as we think about a first commercial facility. Ultimately, our products will go where there is demand for them, and having a low-carbon fuel standard in Oregon increases the demand here in the state where we're going to be producing the fuel. And having a first commercial plant coming online towards the end of 2013 or early 2014, being able to know that more than just a year of production, we need to have that sunset extended beyond 2015 so that we don't have a commercial plant operating for only a year and then that policy disappears.
Great. Thank you. Representative Boone?
Just a quick thing. If I'm wrong, correct me, but I was looking for the feedstock, and it's wheat straw.
Co-chairs, Representative, the primary feedstock is going to be woody biomass, specifically hybrid poplar trees from Greenwood Resources. But the technology is flexible in being able to use wheat straw, other types of agricultural residues, forest residues, and waste, so that we really do have the opportunity then to work with what is available in the local community. Biomass is the single most significant cost factor in the overall life cycle cost to produce a gallon of biofuel or bio-based chemical, whatever your end product is. The feedstock accounts for more than 50% of that production cost. The transportation of that feedstock significantly then drives the overall cost of the feedstock. So by having very tight logistics between where the feedstock is located and where that production facility is located drives the ultimate economics of the end product.
Thank you. And I think my point is that I was thinking you were going to say that. We are considering a bill in my other committee, in Ag and Natural Resources, about, I think it's 2936. It's a biomass bill that provides a tax credit for woody biomass, and that would be the transportation piece of it. So that's it's. I see this then as that would help in the transportation cost piece of this puzzle. And I guess my last comment would be these are the kinds of things that they're kind of innovative. I was accused of being in love with wave energy today by a certain senator, but I didn't think that was possible. However, working in the ocean energy sector, similar paradigms that exist in order to get the funding for the projects, you have to have the pieces in place, and things have to line up from transportation costs to manufacturing workforce and the obvious thing, the source, which is in the wave action. So I think this is another piece of the big puzzle, and one of the things that I made a point of was in my district, Tillamook PUD has run up against the end of the line in power purchase agreements with BPA, and I didn't say the entire message, which was everybody has. They're done, and it's all allotted out for the next 20 years, if I'm not mistaken. So we are looking for and depending on new sources of renewable energy to provide the pieces that we have to do to meet the RPS standard requirements. So I think long way around this is saying, you know, this will even help if you do use wheat straw. It will help our wheat farmers in the east side of the state as well. So try to be innovative in that.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Pence. Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as one who has been a supporter of low carbon fuel standards, I also believe that there is reason to be cautious, and perhaps for entirely different reasons than we've heard here today. And is it Gestalem?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Closely, Jana. Will that be all right? It's easier. Thank you. And I don't mean to bore down on only one statement that she made, but it brings to light, it focuses on my concern, and the statement was is that the only certainty is that, and I'm paraphrasing, that oil prices and presumably by extension carbon-based fuels will prices will be increasing. I think that's correct, but I don't think that that's at the exclusion of green-based fuels, and if it is, I think then it has to presume that our supply curve is ever shifting rightward. And if that's the case, Mr. Chairman, in an earlier life, I had the occasion to do a bit of oral history with some loggers who earned a living in this state back in the late 40s and early 50s. And their perception, I think, from that time period was that their supply shift, their supply curve was always shifting rightward. And I would suggest to you strongly that that kind of attitude, that kind of approach, led to some very significant environmental and ecological problems in this state. And if we are to believe that our feedstocks are an unending supply, in light of, if I am to believe what we're being told, ever-increasing utilization of biomass, I think we land back in the very same position, the very same mentality that an unending supply of old-growth timber presented us when we approached that back in the 1950s. Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Witt. I think that's a would be a good subject for additional conversation, and appreciate you bringing it up. Appreciate members of this panel, as well as the previous, and representatives from the department and our economist. Thank you all. With that, we will close the informational hearing on the low-carbon fuel standard and close the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water.